This is Radio EcoShock.
Dan Glass is a member of the aviation group Plain Stupid. I met him in Vancouver during the Aviation Justice Tour. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, Dan.
Hiya.
You've been to the Occupy Vancouver tent site, I gather, outside the art gallery. What are your impressions there?
Good question. I'm very inspired by all the insurgencies, you know, from Occupy Vancouver to Occupy London to all over the world. It's on one hand great that people are rising up against injustice and inequality everywhere. That goes without saying. But I think we constantly need to be efficient with our strategy and not allow people to get tired and support each other to be able to continue and make these permanent spaces. We don't want this just to be a flash in the pan, because we've got a lot of stuff to do when it comes to reducing inequality and tackling injustice. So if we really want to be a spanner in the works, we've got to take the occupiers from outside the accepted places of parks and etc. to the financial districts. We can't pat ourselves on the back until we've actually achieved our objective of rooting out capitalists and people who are enjoying perpetuating capitalism at the expense of environmental and social justice. So I hope this is just the start, and then we'll continuing to be a spanner in the works for the real perpetrators.
And you've used the word justice, and you're calling this the Aviation Justice Tour. Most people don't associate those two words together. Why have you called it that?
Because I'm talking a lot from a UK perspective, but I'm very thankful that discussions and conversations about climate change over the last few years have turned into conversations about climate justice, because it's increasingly obvious who's causing the problems and who's bearing the brunt of the impacts. So that doesn't just go for aviation, but all manners of environmental injustice, whether it's mining, whether it's motorways, whether it's coal-fired power stations, whether it's the tar sands, or whether it's Heathrow Airport or New York Airport. It's predominantly economically marginalized and or communities of color, often the same things, who are affected and disproportionately affected by these big carbon-heavy industries. And a lot of the time, it's your white, straight males in the World Bank, the World Trade Organizations, British airport authorities, etc., at the top of the parliamentary systems, who are perpetuating the problems. So often and increasingly, we're seeing the battle lines being drawn around social and environmental injustice on race, class, gender grounds. Who's causing the problems and who's bearing the brunt of it? And we have to realize the war that's going on when it comes to climate change, you know, because it's not hard to see the acute impacts on the ground. So when we talk about aviation, we're not against aviation and flying per se, you know, by any means. We obviously understand that if someone from, you know, New York wants to get to Australia, you're not going to be able to get there on a train. But what we are against is anything which is not living within our ecological means by the very virtue of being dependent on the life systems of the planet, on health, with healthy food, clean air, protection, etc. We need to live within our ecological means, and therefore that means drastically reducing airport expansion plans and taking that money and putting it into sustainable land transport alternatives whilst we still can. You know, we need to live in a world which supports people to be able to live sustainably, and therefore all that money which is being put into polluting the skies at night needs to be supporting trains, coaches, sustainable land transport. So that's why it's really an issue of justice, because what we're fighting for is affordable methods of communication and transport for everyone, and also we're against the disproportionate burden of the problems on certain communities.
Yes, you know, in North America, there were a lot of cheap flights available by airlines. I mean, they were underpricing them, I think. Some of them went bankrupt several times. And what that did was it kind of stopped the ability for high-speed rail. We didn't get any high-speed rail systems put in North America. And I think it's because of cheap flights. What's your take on it?
Definitely agree. Definitely agree. Again, I'm talking from a UK perspective because that's what I know best, but it resonates a lot. And I'm sure, I have no doubt that it's a lot of the same situations. So in the UK, the aviation industry gets to the tune of 9 billion tax breaks, right? £9 billion tax breaks in subsidies, whilst every other sector of society is told to reduce their carbon emissions to fit in with our climate change goals. The aviation industry is allowed to continue to expand relentlessly. You know, if the airports in the UK continue to expand in the way that the government the UK government white paper sets out to do, it will, the aviation industry will take more than 100% of the UK's carbon budget by 2050, which is completely nonsensical when we think about what we need to do to reduce carbon emissions. And it's completely unfair for every other sector of society. So while aviation is continued to allow to expand relentlessly, it also does that tax-free and with aviation subsidies of £9 billion. So it really is a question of why the hell are we allowing the aviation industry, which when you put it in line with all the other important sectors of society, such as food and energy and other transport, as well as the others, and the education sector, etc. Why is it the aviation industry is put on a pedestal? And for me, many reasons that aviation industry has such a capture on the imagination. You know, often when you say to people, well, I'm not going to fly, I'm going to try and look for alternative transport means to get from A to B, people are like, well, how the hell are you going to do that? And actually, it really says that the psychological grip that the aviation industry has on us, it makes us not be able to think of alternatives. And actually, there was life before flying, you know. And I'm not saying that we go back to live in an era where we live in, you know, caves or mud huts by any means. I'm not anti-development. What I'm saying is that we need to look at the sustainable, affordable alternatives before the rising sea levels get a lot worse. And actually, we only have a few years of stopping the clock in terms of stopping irreversible climate change. We need to put our money where our mouth is and support the high-speed train services. So yes, I completely agree. Every single airport expansion plan is taking money and scarce energy away from looking at high-speed rail links. So that's where we've got to focus our attention. And Plain Stupid, one of the groups who I organise with, we actually have a sister group called Train Smart. So it's about saying no to ridiculous airport expansion plans and yes to smart, sustainable, affordable train services.
And yet you've actually had some fun along the way with some bright ideas to get across this airport activism, if you want to call it that. And I heard that in 2008 you got rather attached to the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. Would you tell us about that?
Oh, the good old superglue incident. I'm not going to live that one down ever, I don't think. So in 2008, you may have heard about it in the North American press. So I'd won an award for campaigning. I've been spending the last few years working with communities who live under flight paths. And I'm sure there's listeners here who've lived under a flight path and who've lived with a daily brutal onslaught of getting woken up at 4 o'clock every morning or even earlier by illegal levels of noise pollution, who've lived with higher rates of asthma and cancer in their communities, who've lived with black dots on their laundry when they hang it up outside because of the vast pollution which is being dropped down on your houses. Anyway, so I've been organising with communities on public health grounds really for the past few years all across the UK. When I got this invitation through my door saying, you know, you've won this award for your campaigning work for working with communities affected by airport expansion and the patron is Gordon Brown, Prime Minister, so welcome to 10 Downing Street, I was like, hang on a second, I cannot live with myself accepting an award from the guy who's wedded to the aviation industry, who wants to expand one of the world's largest airports, Heathrow Airport Expansion, when I'm getting the award for working with people who are affected by the problems. No, I'm not going to do that. So I said to my mate who I was with at the time, I said, well, what can I do to highlight the hypocrisy? And she said, I don't know. Well, why don't you just collect testimony from all the communities that you work with, make it into a speech and say it to him when you superglue yourself to his arm? And I was like, you know what? That's a very good idea. And she said, no, I was joking. Don't superglue yourself to the Prime Minister. But the thought had already gone in and I was determined to do it. And in line with Plain Stupid's actions and creative actions and importance of civil disobedience in, you know, the fine fundamental workings of democracy, I did just that. And so I spent the month beforehand practicing on my housemate, the unsung hero. Every evening it was like, Stephen, come over here, super glue time after dinner. He was like, okay, Dan. And so, because I wanted to obviously make sure that my hand was on his sleeve, I didn't want to do it hand on hand because that could have been an assault and that was obviously not what the intention was, and you don't want a bleeding Prime Minister off your hand anyway and making chit chat in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. It would have been completely off message. And so in the end, what I worked out to do was having super glue in little bags attached to the outside of my boxers, and I had a hole in my trouser pocket so that when it was my turn to shake the Prime Minister's hand, I would superglue myself to his arm. And so when it came to my time, I was obviously very nervous. I'd come down on the bus the night before and was actually sitting next to a pilot, with the irony of it, talking about, you know, he was talking about how he's scared about climate change and he's worried about being embroiled in the aviation industry as a pilot. Quite ironic that that was the conversation I had the night down to superglue myself to the Prime Minister, not that he knew. So when it came to my turn, I put my hand into my pocket and squeezed the super glue onto my hand, and then shook my hand with my right hand and his right hand, and stuck myself to his sleeve, and I said, "Don't move, Mr. Prime Minister." And the whole room went quiet, and I said, "If you move, it'll hurt the both of us. I have just to say, I have super glued myself to your sleeve to say that you can run away from my arm eventually, but you can't run away from climate change." And all the while, he was looking at me very strangely, trying to prise his fingers off my arm. And the whole room was like, "Okay, what's going on here?" And I said, "Don't worry, this is a peaceful stunt in line with Plain Stupid's commitment to peaceful action." And everyone breathed a sigh of relief. They realised I wasn't going to blow up or anything. And then I said, "You know, I have stuck to myself to your arm to say that we can beat climate change, but it ain't going to come about by expanding the world's largest airport, such as Heathrow." And then the crowd, which was made up a lot of campaigners and human rights lawyers and advocates and stuff, were clapping and cheering because they realised what was going on. "You know, it's time that you stood up to the bullies of British airport authorities and stood up for the British public." And by that time, there was a lot of cheers and support. And that was that. I mean, actually, what the hell were they expecting? You know, I've got an award for campaigning. It's a campaigner's and an active citizen's duty to look for opportunities to highlight hypocrisies and injustices. And I took just that. And that action was the biggest news story in the world the next day, much to my mum's horror. That was just one action which contributed to a whole years-long campaigns, from direct actions to community actions to petitions, which finally put an end to the Heathrow Third Runway.
And in Aberdeen, Scotland, you were arrested, I understand. What came of that?
So, Aberdeen Airport is another. In Scotland alone, there's 17 airport expansion plans, which again puts into jeopardy all the whole climate change targets. You know, Scotland, where I've lived for the past few years, prides itself on having the strongest climate change bill in the world. Very good on paper, but if it means nothing in practice, I am not interested. So in actual fact, they want to expand every airport, and it's just like, we're not stupid. The general public isn't stupid. We're not daft. Don't try and pull the walls over eyes. You can't have your cake and eat it. If you want to have the strongest climate change bill in the world, great, I'll support you, but I will not support you if it means lying to us. And you know, Aberdeen, we focus on doing an action in Aberdeen because America's very own Donald Trump, as you probably know, wants to build his fancy golf course on a site of scientific special interest in a place, local community called Paradise in Aberdeen. A beautiful, beautiful, ecologically rich place. And so here comes Donald Trump. I want to build a golf course. And therefore, he's expanding, he's pushing to expand Aberdeen Airport. So Plain Stupid and our allies aren't just against the aviation industry's unsustainable expansions, but the industries who support it, such as Donald Trump's golf course. And so what we were saying is that if Donald Trump can play golf on ridiculous places, such as site of scientific special interest, then so can we. Therefore, dressing up as Donald Trump and nine of us going on to Aberdeen Airport taxiway in the middle of the night when the airport was closed and played golf on a cage in the runway. And our balls, the golf balls, for example, were all written with names of site of areas in the world which are affected by climate change, such as Bangladesh, sub-Saharan Africa, and local places in the UK, such as Meany, the site where he wants to build the golf course. And so it was very symbolic that actually he's playing golf with our future. And so we stopped, I can't remember the exact number, but hundreds of tons, possibly thousands of tons of carbon emissions from taking off in those few flights. And obviously pissed off Donald Trump as well, which was part of our objective, because we are targeting greedy, selfish people like him as well. That was the action, playing golf on Aberdeen Airport taxiway. But actually, the trial was extremely important in that as well. We always knew that we were going to make something of the trial, when we always knew that obviously we were going to end up in court. If you get arrested because you're playing golf on a runway, then clearly you are going to end up in court. But what was very important to us is that we make a lot of noise during the whole court trial as well, because actually the legal system has responsibility as well in terms of environmental and social protection. They can't run, just as the rest of us can't run away from climate change. And so actually what the whole point was taking the fight from the court of the public to the court of the law and saying, you must properly encapsulate environmental protection. And so we use the laws of necessity, of a lawful excuse, which is stopping a higher crime. And that's been very profound in the UK before, when six people got on top of a coal-fired power station in the south of England and stopped it from working and caused £30,000 worth of criminal damage. And the jury, they unanimously acquitted them on the grounds of lawful excuse, saying, yeah, okay, they generated £30,000 worth of criminal damage, but they were stopping a high crime, which is climate change, which in the long run and currently is going to cost thousands, hundreds of millions and the rest of damage because of the impacts of climate change. So that was what we were saying, that actually the legal system has a responsibility. But not only that, on our defence stand were people from a vast area of interest who are all looking at the importance of climate change, civil disobedience. So we had public health professionals who quite rightly were concerned, because what the World Health Council says is that by 2020, depression and anxiety and other associated illnesses to do with the precarity of living within such precarious conditions of climate change will be one of the biggest killers, particularly of the younger generation. So they were there supporting us. We had anti-poverty activists who were saying that actually money shouldn't be given to the aviation industry, but it should be put into public housing and insulating our homes and stopping fuel poverty. So we were making the connections there, as well as a whole range of other people who were saying what they're doing is right. I maybe wouldn't have been on that taxiway because I've got kids and I've got family and I've got other responsibilities, but right on for what they were doing.
All right, so you've come here to North America. You were planning on doing a whole tour of Canada and the United States, but something got in your way, something happened. What happened?
Well, John Stewart and myself were invited to North America on tour, basically, because there's over 3,000 airport expansion plans in North America, which just puts a shiver down my spine, because it really puts things into perspective, because I know how hard it was with the whole Heathrow third runway. Even though it was a success in the end, it was a lot of work, and I wasn't there for half of it, really. And then when I hear about Chicago O'Hare's eighth runway expansion, New York JFK's, I think, eighth runway, etc., it really is devastating, not only for how damaging that is for if we are globally ever to stop the worst impacts of climate change, but what it means for those communities under the flight path as well, facing their eighth runway. You know, I saw firsthand what it was like for the community under the Heathrow flight path, and that was only the third runway, you know. So we were invited to Skillshare about how we campaigned, how we built alliances, how we got, you know, unexpected alliances such as the Conservative Party and fiscal conservatives in the UK to jump on the bandwagon as well. We were asked to Skillshare and provide some semblance of hope as well for people who've been campaigning for so many years. So we were invited, and we've been, you know, the program's been in process, we've been organizing for a whole year. And it's a real reminder for me that actually it's so important that the biggest polluters such as the UK, Canada and the US, you know, in the belly of the beast, that's where we need to stop airport expansion and the tar sands and motorway expansion and all the other toys of industrial civilization. So that's where we need to start. If we are ever to tackle climate change, we need to start here. And so we were invited, but when I went to go for my interview to get my visa, because you have to get a visa interview if you go on a boat, I was already very much looking forward to go from the boat from Liverpool to Chester, taking time off work, especially for that 9-day journey. Anyway, I went to get my visa in to have my visa interview, and I knew that it might be touch and go because of, you know, the activism that I've been involved with before. So I turned up with a whole ring binder full of letters of support from senators, congressmen and women, Parliament MPs from England, MSPs from Scotland, human rights lawyers, public health advocates, you name it, I had them in that file. But before I even got to show the file, I was met by Eric Jackson from the FBI at the front door, who said, "Are you Dan Glass?" Sorry for my American accent, it's awful. But he said, "Are you Dan Glass?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Hi, I'm Eric Jackson. I'm from the FBI. I've come to talk to you about the incident." And I was thinking, which incident are you talking about? If I didn't say that, he said, "You know, I've come to talk to you about the super glue." And I was like thinking, oh, that one. There's so much which has happened since then. I wasn't arrested. Gordon Brown took it with a pinch of salt. You know, it was all seen as in the name of democracy kind of thing. And he was like, "I hope you understand why I'm here. I'm Obama's right-hand man. And I just, you know, I've come here to ask what you would do if you met Obama." And I'm like, I'm not going to superglue myself to Obama. You know, that was a stunt of its time. As a campaigner, it's important to have fresh campaigning tactics all the time. And fundamentally, I'm not some kind of weird superglue addict. And I said, "Well, also, hang on a second. Are you telling me that you've flown from the White House to London to Belfast to ask me a few questions? Are you not missing the point of our protest about unnecessary flying?" And he was like, I'm sorry. And I said, "Well, next time, call me up when you want to have a chat." And so he was like, "You know, I hope you can understand why I'm here. I'm here to protect Obama." And I can understand. But actually, it's totally ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous that, you know, the American government should undermine the First Amendment of their constitution, which is freedom of speech. And I'm not going to superglue myself to Obama. You know, I'm not going anywhere near him. You know, we've come to talk about environmental education, about campaigning, about civil rights, about the importance of free speech, which is what the constitution is founded upon. So we see there's some irregularity when it comes to the American government keeping to their fundamental principles. But anyway, before he took me away from the building, took me to his Hummer. There was a table and he pulled out some deck chairs next to the Hummer. And I was like, could this be any more cliched? And we had this whole conversation. You know, he asked me what school I've been to, what my family are doing, all of this. And he was like, I just can't believe it's you. You're a nice, young, articulate man. And I was like thinking, well, what do you expect? Do you expect me to turn up doused in superglue with a D-lock around my neck? And then, you know, we had a long conversation. He was like, well, I think it's very, and after that, actually, he was like, I think it's very important what you do, you know. It's important that people stand up for their beliefs, etc. And then I finally had my interview with a guy in the office. And he said, oh, hello, Dan. And I said, hello. He said, so what do you want to do in America? And I showed him all the letters of support. It's an environmental education tour talking about the importance of campaigning and stopping pollution and poverty, etc. He said, oh, okay, very nice. I've been reading all about you and I hear you want to superglue yourself to Sarah Palin. And I was like, oh my God, no, come on, what is this? And, you know, obviously it really made me flustered because it makes me think, what lengths is the American government willing to go to, A, you know, look at me, look at what I'm doing, you know, look at my history, tap my phone, look at my emails and whatever about all the organization for the Aviation Justice Express Tour. But the lengths that they're willing to go to stop freedom of expression as well. And actually, you know, civil rights and people's action is one of the most inspiring things that's come out of America and Canada over the past hundreds and the rest years. And so it's a real eye-opener to the levels of suppression going on to keep business going as usual. You know, we're ordinary people. We're young, old, students, workers, you know, trade union workers, teachers, scientists, doctors. I'm a youth worker, you know, people who are just doing what they can to stop climate change spiraling out of control. But anyway, that was my situation. And then I thought it would be okay for John. You know, John hasn't superglued themselves to the Prime Minister. You know, he's been a campaigner on pollution and poverty and climate change for years. He's the older generation for me. He's one of the nicest men I've ever met. And when I heard that when he got on the flight, because he only got a month off work, he hasn't flown ever across the Atlantic. And when he got on his flight and when the flight turned up at New York JFK Airport, John, one of the nicest, humblest men, six FBI agents came onto the plane in front of everyone and arrested him, dragged him off the plane, took him through New York customs and questioned him for 6 hours. And then sent him packing to the UK, sent him home, sent back to London. When I first heard this, it was like, what is going on here? And they were saying to him, you know, maybe apply for your visa again after the tour. So obviously, it's so crystal clear that they do not want John to speak about aviation justice. They do not want John, who's been voted the most effective environmental campaigner in the UK by the Independent on Sunday, a well-respected paper. They do not want him to talk about how to challenge business as usual, which is threatening people's fundamental right to clean air, water, health, etc. And there's a reason why they don't want John talking about aviation justice, because actually we've got to ask, where is the American government's interest? Is it with business as usual, or is it with people's fundamental rights to air, water, shelter, etc.? So, you know, the very fact that they say try again for your visa after the tour is very telling about what they don't want us to talk about. So then, you know, obviously John's back in the UK, and what's been very interesting is, whilst the American government don't want us to talk, haven't wanted the tour to go ahead, therefore not giving either of us our visas which were requested by all the communities in the US and Canada who are living with the impacts of pollution and poverty, you know, actually the tour has grown probably four times the size because of the FBI's suppression of our voices. There's been loads more attention. And so it's been an own goal for them, because quite rightly, people do not want their fundamental right to discuss things freely taken away. So there's been loads more interest. We've had loads more events, workshops, actions. Granted, a lot of them have been over Skype. But actually, you know, that's part of the issue. We can communicate without sitting on a plane. We can communicate across Skype, across video conferencing and everything. So it's been brilliant in many ways. There's been a lot more interest to the tour. And what really got me was when the FBI, when they were questioning John was saying, oh, you don't want to hang around Dan Glass. He's a dangerous extremist. He's trouble. He's out to cause civil disobedience. And it really makes me think, it's like, hang on, you're the one with the First Amendment, which says freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And whether that means challenging the status quo or not, you're the one who is essentially calling for people putting their head above the parapet, and then you say that I'm a dangerous radical, but actually what I'm doing is not radical. It's fundamentally reasonable in the current political context of prioritizing aviation industry over the wealth and health of the majority of the planet. So what I'm doing is fundamentally reasonable. It's not asking for anything too extreme to say, oh, sorry, can we not live with cancer and asthma and irreversible climate change? Actually, I think I'm quite reasonable.
Well, we're starting to run a little bit low on time, but I would like you to just briefly tell us you're heading off to Athabasca country or to have a look at the tar sands. What's up there?
We're going to the tar sands because obviously a lot of the UK industries, such as RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, sorry, a lot of the British banks are very much involved in the promotion of the tar sands. Around the world, people are looking at Canada and Canada's responsibilities for not contributing to climate change. It's been very interesting going across Canada, met some amazing people, brilliant communities who are all exposing the myths that Canada is a fine, upstanding example of what it means to be environmentally and socially responsible, predominantly because of their promotion of the tar sands. Of course, it's an example of not just environmental injustice, but racial injustice and social injustice because of who's causing the problems, such as your white British bankers over in the Royal Bank of Scotland and perpetuating the destruction of profoundly inspiring indigenous communities around the tar sands. And what we're finding out is the relationship between oil and aviation. I don't know the exact figures, that's what we're going to discuss, but the significant amount of the tar sands, which ends up in the jet fuel, and particularly military jet fuel, a lot of tar sands oil goes straight to the US government, which is partly used for the energy sector and partly used for the military, particularly military jet fuel. So we can see very clearly the relationship between war, the relationship between energy and the tar sands and aviation. And I think what's particularly important at the moment in 2011, when people are rising up all over the world against injustice, is joining the dots. You know, Plain Stupid has kind of looked at one end of the fossil fuel production line, but we're now looking at the other end. And so we're in solidarity with people who are challenging the tar sands, just as we're about working with people who are under the flight paths in Heathrow, just as we're about supporting Indian indigenous communities who are tackling massive bauxite mining in India, which is used to make the planes. So we see a lot of the connections here. And again, I'm not saying I'm against flying per se, but everything that we do, that we look through, has to be within our ecological means, because in 2011, humanity is such a desperate, strange, dangerous place that we have to really reflect on where we want to be in 50 years' time. And I often think that the next generation will either look at us and thank us for doing what we're doing or condemn us for not taking enough action. So it's been a real pleasure being in Canada and meeting so many inspiring, amazing communities and campaigners. And I foresee that connections and relationships from UK to the US to Canada will only be made stronger as the issues of climate change become more stark, because actually it's not any more an issue of moral responsibility and finger waggling and you shouldn't fly there and you should eat that and you shouldn't, you should recycle your plastic bags, but an issue of self-defense and realizing that we have to protect our communities and ourselves because the situation's so stark, and if we don't, we're only going to die ourselves.
Well, that's partly what Radio EcoShock is trying to do. We're broadcasting in London now. We've got an American audience. We've got a Canadian audience. We've got a little bit of an audience in Australia. And so it's a global problem, obviously, climate change is, but also the whole transportation industry and the way it's sort of abusing communities, from my point of view, financially, with just more and more subsidies and billions of dollars going into something. We haven't even had time to touch on peak oil and the fact that they're building all this infrastructure, the world's biggest airport in China and so on. Where are they going to get the oil to do it? It just gets dirtier and dirtier, as we see with the tar sands. So there's a lot going on there. I want to ask you, as we finish up, do you have some websites that you could recommend for our listeners to follow up on this?
Sure. Oh, wow. God, I've got so many websites. Okay, so there's Plain Stupid, which is plain, P-L-A-N-E, stupid.com. We've got So We Stand, which is S-O-W-E-S-T-A-N-D, which makes the connections between environmental, racial and social injustice. We've got aviationjustice.org, which is the tour. Then there's a whole wealth of other links from the US to Canada to the UK of a range of groups who are building amazing food growing programs under the flight path in Heathrow, to ideas of community resistance.com, which is the website following other aspects around building healthy neighbourhoods, which we've been witnessing across Canada. Just one thing I wanted to say in terms of motivations. We're constantly working out in our head. We're motivated to take action because of the horror stories we continually see about witnessing injustice, etc. We're motivated to take action not just because of the things that we hate, such as climate change, etc., but by things of what we love. You know, if you love your family, if you love the good things in life, if that's taking a walk in the park or music or culture or arts, etc., we're fighting to keep them because we love them. But for me, I've been thinking about it a lot, and as a young-ish, I don't know how long I can say that for, person impacted by climate change, as most people are, and probably going to be around for a bit longer to see it firsthand, how it's going to spiral out of control. I'm also utterly embarrassed at what's going on. I often think, what will the next dominant species think of human beings when we're all wiped out? You know, I picture them, whatever they may look like, sitting around their tables, whatever they may look like, with their children, and when their children are looking through their history books, wherever they may look like, and saying, Mum, Dad, you know, what are these things, you know, human beings? Why were they around for such a short amount of time? And then the mum and dad say, oh dear, don't look at them as an example for how to live, you know. They were so stupid. They died out of their own stupidity because they've cut off their own life support systems and supported ridiculous things like airport expansions at the expense of, you know, sustainable train systems or clean air and clean water, etc. So what I'm saying is I don't want our human species to die out of our own stupidity, because we're not stupid, because we're not stupid enough to allow a few people's greed and their toys such as private jets to take the rest of our livelihoods away. And so I'm motivated by horror and hope and embarrassment as well as what human beings may look like to the next dominant species. So we've all got our own emotional motivations to take action, and so it's important to share them.
Here's to horror, hope, and embarrassment with activist Dan Glass. It's been a real pleasure. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.